From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy, social and civil rights issues affecting communities of color. I'm Don Cravens, Jr., Senior Vice President of Policy for the National Urban League and Executive Director of its Washington Bureau. Last week, you heard episode one of a two-part series that we recorded from the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation's annual legislative conference. As you know, each September, the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation hosts its annual legislative conference. This event attracts thousands of people from all over America, and people come here for programming, networking opportunities, professional development, and for panel discussions. If you've never been, please join us next year, next September, for the Congressional Black Caucus annual legislative conference. As we discussed last week's episode, during the conference, the Urban League had a series of events as well. And one of the events we had was a panel discussion entitled Mobilizing the Black Community for Sustainable Social Change. Our moderator, Quentin James, is the co-founder of the Collective Pact. And we had some very esteemed panelists, including founder of Black Millennials for Flint, Latricia Adams, St. Louis County Prosecutor-elect, Wesley Bell, Charlottesville, Virginia Vice Mayor Wes Bellamy, Senior Pastor of Community of Hope AME Church and convener of the Black Male Initiative, Reverend Tony Lee, and last but not least, co-founder and partner at Think Rubrics, creator of hashtag Woke Vote, DeWanna Thompson. And so if you didn't listen to last week's episode, take a listen to it before listening to this second part of that panel discussion. The panel discussion was well over an hour, so we broke it up into two episodes. This is the second part of that episode. Please enjoy and listen and stay tuned to Mobilizing the Black Community for Sustainable Social Change.
I do want to ask one more question. So in my opinion, everybody who's here is a representative, right? You represent people back home who aren't in Washington, D.C. with suit and ties on in a convention center talking about black progress on a Thursday or Wednesday, whatever day this is. So my question for the panelists is what we saw in 2016, I think Mr. Morial, Mayor Morial talked about before, is that a lot of people lost hope in our community in the political process leading up to 2016. They thought their vote didn't matter. They thought that, whatever. I don't want to vote for lesser of two evils, whatever their psyche was. What are we saying to those folks in 2018? But also from your seats where you are around the country, what is the psyche of Black America? Like, do you think folks understood what happened now? You think we got a lot more work to do? We'd love to kind of hear from you all, because as these folks are ready to kind of go back home, what is the message they should be taking to their communities in terms of folks who are maybe not paying attention, maybe just tuning in? Because let's be honest, most campaigns really gear up after Labor Day, right? So we're just now really getting into campaign season, per se, with TV ads, radio ads, staff working on the ground. So what are your thoughts right now about the moment previously that we were in terms of what people were thinking?
I want to take this one, if you don't mind.
Please, yeah.
A quick
please.
Second. I think so it's really important for us to know that Black folk, we are definitely not only some of the most progressive and understanding and competent individuals on the planet, not just in the country, but we are indeed very aware of what's going on. I think sometimes the media and other individuals like to try and shape our policies in terms of what we're trying to accomplish in a way or a manner in which it likes to portray us as if we don't care. But in fact, the fact of the matter is that all of you are here because you care. The fact that we can elevate Black women, Black men, and support each other on a day-to-day basis via social media, via donating, via using your time to do community service, or whether that be volunteering for campaigns or signing up for civic organizations, shows that we care. And there are a whole lot more of us doing it now than we've seen in years before. Now, Minister Farrakhan said something at the Million Man March a few years back, the second one, where he said he believed that young folk today were the boldest group that he's seen in nearly 50 years. And I thought to myself, well, that's a bold, progressive statement. But then I started thinking about it. When you look at the movements that are occurring right now, you don't see black folk, specifically young black folk, standing idle or sitting back. We're normally very loud. We're normally willing to protest and march, and we're willing to do the work that others don't think that we're willing to do. And we will be visible about it because we're going to put it on every social media platform that you can think of. So when we think about that, I think it shows that the progress in which we've made is great indeed. Now, is there more work for us to do? Yes, we had a 400-year late start. Obviously, there's going to be more work for us to do. But please do not don't negate the work that's being done, because honestly, we could pat ourselves on the back for the progress that we've made. I don't think the Irish or any of these other subgroups, I'm not going to go into these other ethnic groups, but I don't think that they could overcome what we've been able to and still rise to the top like we are right now. That's not a medium that you can look in and you don't see black folk in some way scratching through, breaking through. The sports they thought we couldn't get involved in, whether that's tennis or cricket, we dominate. Whether that's the White House or your local office, we get in. No matter what the medium or platform is, we find a way to get there, no matter how you try to keep us away from it. And then when we get in, we do well. So be proud of that.
All right.
Thank you.
The only thing that I would say to that is I'm a person who follows the numbers. And I feel a certain kind of way when people say something about 2016, because Black America did not let this country down in 2016. We did our part. And we need to just stand on the fact that we voted at the highest percentages for the most progressive candidates across any board, across any demographic in this country. And I think that it sometimes frustrates me when we hear something like even the fact that, oh, it's black women's time now. It's like black women been undergirding this country for years. And so I don't need you to tell me right now how to organize my own communities. Don't give me a seat at the table. Give me the lumber to build my own table, right? Let us allow us to do the things that we know that we need to do for our own communities so that we don't keep having the same turnout and the same issues that we had in 2016. And let's be clear, 2016 was a result of 2014. It was a result of what happened in 2010. This is a cyclical situation that we are dealing with in this country, that people do not invest in our midterm strategies, particularly as black people and communities of color. They do not invest in our infrastructure, particularly in the South. And so when people, our firm, I know Iffy and Tristan is in here, and David and some of our other people are here, and I appreciate you, but one of the things that we hate to hear is when people say low propensity voters. What does that even mean? Especially if you haven't put any resources on the ground to engage that voter. Right. And so we're not going to take those same labels going into 2018 and beyond. Mm-hmm. The other thing is we have to be clear that they have not been able to accurately organize, but they have not been able to accurately assess our numbers. The polling that's done in our communities is whack. The program, the research that is done in our communities is off. And that is primarily because we do not have as many black owned or minority owned firms that do polling research and those kinds of things. And that's because it's not seen as a black or brown field. But there are brilliant strategists who know numbers, who crunch research, who can tell us what we need to do to continue to win our communities. And so I want us to think about what that looks like going into 2020, what that looks like for the census, that if we do not show up and count our people accurately, we will lose whole communities and we will lose whole lines, right? We're already seeing that in North Carolina. We're already seeing what they're trying to do in Mississippi. And so I just wanted to highlight the fact that, yes, we know that it's critical what happens to happen in 2018. We were also on the ground. Quinn and I have been working together in other countries and all over this country for years. But it doesn't make any sense that he had $4 million to somebody's $12 million, right? And that was because people didn't believe. We got to bet on black this year. And we got to keep betting on black for the next several years so all we right. can do what we need to do.
Every year.
Every
So, yeah, I just want to jump in there quickly. I'm a grassroots advocate, so let me just be clear. Every campaign that I've been involved in has been grassroots. And one thing that I've seen consistently, and it's not just me, but, you know, doing research, is that particularly in poor communities or African-American communities, you got to go ask for the vote.
That's right.
It's not just going to come to you. You have to go out there and ask for the vote, and that means knocking on doors. That means losing a lot of weight because you're doing a lot of walking. I dropped about 10 pounds. I'm about 5 pounds up now. I'm getting back there. But you got to go out there and ask for that vote. And so we knew looking – so, and I'll give you an example. Going into the election in February, they did a poll, and that poll had us at about 26% to our opponents' 44%. Now, if you're halfway intelligent, which I probably am not, you're probably thinking you don't have a chance. But what, as a grassroots activist or a grassroots organizer, whatever you want to call it, what we knew is that oftentimes African Americans, which in St. Louis County, North County, most African Americans live in North County, do not vote in primary elections. So when they're running their polling, they're not getting African American votes from those particular areas. So so the way we looked at it is that we have a 27-year incumbent who is not even polling at 50%. So we assumed all those extra votes, the 28% that was undecided, was ours. Also, what we knew is that we were going to knock on doors. Mm-hmm. We were going to get out at every event. We were going to knock, go in every neighborhood, and we were going to increase the turnout. And so, and that's exactly what ended up happening. So about a week before the election, a poll was done, and it had him at 43 to our 37. At that point, no lie, my campaign manager is here. We won. We knew we won. Because again, those primary voters were not counted. We're only down 5 points. We ended up winning 56. We got 56% of the vote to his 43. Now, there's another side of that coin, though. That took a lot of work. Grassroots takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of energy. And so if we are going to truly push and make sustainable change, which is the name of this particular program, we have to make a habit of voting in every single election, regardless if someone knocks on our door or not. You are right. The Democratic Party oftentimes does not put the resources and takes our vote for granted. That's true. Having said that, if we come out in large numbers in every single election, because there's other areas that they take for granted too, South County and St. Louis, it's taken for granted. Not a lot of people go out there and campaign, but they still get out and vote. And guess what? When it's time to allocate resources, they still get their share. Yes, North County gets ignored because we don't vote as much. And there's a North County all over the country, right? So what I'm saying is there's going to be local elections in Missouri there in April, wherever your local elections are. We got to get out and vote. Primary elections are going to come around. And then the presidential elections, we have to get out and vote every single time. And then you'll see politicians come into your community, listening to the things that matter to you. And you'll start seeing the sustainable change that we're all looking for.
Awesome. Thank you.
If I can jump in just real quick. One of the things that was important, I think, about DeWanna, just to talk about the work you did in Alabama, is that you all connected to organizations that were already working with the people on the ground. We have to admit that, especially from a liberal kind of thing, that we've got these class distinctions. And we've got this whole kind of class thing that's happening. And a lot of times what happens is that we'll give money to people who are not dealing with the people who need to not just be asked to vote, but need to get the education and the why. Mm-hmm. And so we're telling folks, you need to vote, you need to be anti-Trump, but you're not giving the why about what it will mean to get the House and the Senate. Or you're not talking about the whys about what it means on all the down ticket stuff. And so you have to also be having the folks who can communicate to the folks. One of the things that blessed me about Alabama being there when they were bringing back the results. They were bringing back the results, and we looked up, and all of a sudden, all the black folks started shouting in the room. And all the white folks were like, no, you can't shout. He hasn't won yet, right? And we looked and said, no. all the districts that are left is in the black belt. And we've been in the black belt all daggone day. We've been all the way up and down through the black belt. We know our people didn't vote, how they voted. And so we were shouting the victory. And other folks, no, you're going to jinx it. You're going to jinx it. Like, no, 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 baby. No, we know what our folks did. Because everybody down there was all these sisters and all these organizations that had been working with those folks. And so then when the numbers came, we was like, y'all late on the shout. We told y'all to shout for the victory earlier. It's the black church, daggone it. Shout now. Man, I'm done. I'm good.
Perfect. All right, so we're going to turn to the audience now. Real quick questions, real quick responses. We only got about 10 more minutes, so I want to wrap up. But please.
Thomas Varela, president of Next Philadelphia Young Professionals. This is a question for Latricia and maybe others as well. Knowing your work in terms of black millennials in Flint, I know, knowing you personally, know that you're very specific about intersectionality, really making sure that we're bridging the gap. And to a certain extent, making sure that as young professionals we get off our high horse a bit and make sure that we're really doing the work. What are some of the strategies that you impart on for other young professionals as you're trying to encourage them to realize that you really got to get your hands dirty and address these issues and not get so caught up in thinking that you're on this high horse or part of this talented tenth to be away from that work?
Great question.
So one of the things, and I wanted to circle back, but we ran out of time with that last question that also connects with yours. I think one of the things, and I was able to do this, not necessarily with my work with Black Millennials for Flint specifically, but through the league with serving as president in Memphis. So I think a lot of times we take for granted the whole voting process and how people actually understand that. Oftentimes, especially in local elections, there's a ton of different things on that ballot where people are just voting for who looks familiar, especially when you come from a place like where I come from. So one of the foundational parts of political advocacy for us and the work that we do is around education. And it literally is a focus on like the bare necessities. Like, do you know what a county clerk does? Do you know what the county appraiser does? So literally like going through the ranking of who's responsible for what, because when you tell people to vote and they're like, I'm gonna vote for who you tell me to vote for, but not understanding, like, what is this person really responsible for? How is this person going to address the specific needs that I have? Then people are still unable to advocate for themselves. So it's in two parts where one, educating people around who's on the ballot and what they're supposed to do, but then also building people's capacity around advocacy. So, for example, bringing it back to the East Coast, one of the things that we were able to do was, how do you do a phone bank? So we didn't just say, hey, y'all, come and let's get on the phone. No, we want to show you how to organize a phone bank because we're tired and we're going to need help doing more and more phone banks. How do you testify before a council? So let's do some training around that and let's not automatically assume that people know how to go into these spaces of advocacy and actually have the skills and propensity to actually articulate themselves in a way that will actually get what they need to be addressed. I hope that answered your question.
If I could touch on that really briefly. I think, like, we had this thing called the Black Millennial Convention here in D.C. Early in the year. Latricia got an award for her outstanding work. And my guy, Tyrell Holcomb, who's a commissioner here in D.C., raise your hand, Ty. He helped us put it together in a meal in the back and whatnot. But one thing that we talked about specifically at our Black Millennial Convention was it's okay to be young and be yourself and still run for office or get involved. Like, I like getting crazy parts in my head. That doesn't mean that I'm not qualified to run for office. I'm 31. I got a doctorate. Like, I'm just, it's probably more qualified than anyone else who may come on the ballot. Some people will talk about, well, I've said a lot of crazy stuff in my day. I don't want people going and digging in my past. When I was 20, I said such and such. I went through that firsthand. Like, people will go and dig up all your old tweets and so forth. But that still doesn't mean that you don't have the propensity or the ability to get involved today. So we have to encourage our younger folks and then our folks as a whole that just as Jesus said, come as you are. You need to go to the ballots or get on the ballots just as you are, because trust me, these are the folks who we're running against or who've been in these positions for 20 or 30 years. They have way more dirt than what you've done in your little 25 or 30 years, right? But for some of us, we will think that that's something that's going to disqualify us from getting involved, when in fact, It's actually something that shows you're human.
That's right.
I don't ever want to be a perfect politician. In fact, I don't even like calling myself politician. I'm just a black man that's elected. So when we talk about how do you get involved on your school board, do you know what your planning commission does? Do you understand the zoning in your areas, the training around that, but also then encouraging our folks to get on these boards? So when we're talking about mobilizing, do we bring forth a whole litany or list of the open boards and commissions in your local municipality? And then we can mobilize and say, all right, you're going to take this one. You're going to take planning commission. You're going to run for school board. We're going to make sure we get you $1,000. You're going to get on the place design task force. You're going to get on the swimming board. I don't know, whatever case it may be. You're going to get on parks and rec. And then we're all going to communicate with each other about what kind of strategy we want to implement. Because that's what we think the others do, but they don't. So that means that we can because we're smarter.
Awesome. I love it. All right. Next question.
Afternoon. My name is Margaret Ringler. I'm from the Pretrial Justice Institute. And so I spend a lot of my time thinking about the movement to end money bail. And we've seen that movement get a lot of energy lately from, you know, bold platforms from elected prosecutors and governors-elect Stacey Abrams. And I'm wondering, there's a lot of ideas out there about what ending money bail really looks like. And so I feel like there's a lot at stake. And I'm wondering from the panelists, what do we need to be doing in this movement to make sure it's a decarceral movement, to make sure that that is truly the North Star that we have? And also to your point, Ms. Thompson, we just did a poll about African-American voters' views on money bail, which I'd love to talk to anyone about. So as we're in these movements and they're taking a lot of directions, how do we really focus on that, where we want to go?
And real quick, folks know what money bail is, right? No?
I'll kind of talk about that. So just to be clear, because I don't know, you know, where we are in this particular discussion, but bail is to ensure that the accused appears throughout the criminal justice process. Okay? That's what it's for. It's not for punitive purposes. It's not to punish. It's to ensure your presence if you're accused of a crime. It's to ensure that you will be there and appear throughout the process, mm-hmm. through the trial. Okay? Cash bail is when we're saying, okay, we're going to ask for money, mm-hmm. to ensure that you're going to be there. And here's the problem with it, is that the murderer with means is able to get out.
That's right.
But the nonviolent offender who got caught with some marijuana, property crime, the bond is $1,500 and they can't make it, they sit in jail. And then think about the ancillary effects of that.
That's right.
Most of us don't have jobs that'll be waiting for you if you just don't show up for 2 weeks, right? I don't. Most of us have mortgages or rent to pay, right? And that's due. And if you just don't pay it for 3 weeks because you're locked up, your landlord, unless you just, you know, you staying with your mom, your stuff is probably going to be outside, right?
Right.
But then think about a single mother or a single parent who could lose their children. And we're talking about crimes for the overwhelming majority, we're looking at probation anyway. So why are we incarcerating people, which research shows significantly increases the likelihood that they will offend, even if they haven't offended? Because we know a lot of people get arrested for things they didn't do, right? That happens. I think we all know that, right?
That's right.
Well, guess what? Even a short prison term, stay in jail, significantly increases the likelihood that that person will offend. And so when we talk about cash bail, we see the disparate effect that it has on poor people, particularly people of color, but poor people, whatever you are. And so I've done a lot of work in the juvenile fields. And what they use in Missouri is essentially a risk assessment. If you are a risk to the community, to yourself, you've been charged with a severe crime, you're a risk of flight, they're not going to let you out. And you're going to have to sit there until your trial. But if you're not, why are we keeping you? And so so to answer your question directly, it starts with the education component. That's how we're going to start moving the ball in the right direction. And we're starting to see that. And that's one thing that I'll take from Ferguson as a Ferguson City Councilman. You got to have that public engagement piece. That's one thing I will take with me for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And then I want to say one other point, too. I could not agree more with my name brother right here. You are not your worst day. That is, your worst day doesn't define you. Okay. Having said that, try not to make that same mistake now that you know, okay? Mm-hmm. Because we know, and my mother told me a long time ago, you're going to have to work twice as hard to get what others, you know, get just by entitlement. And so keep in mind, there's a lot of, there's some extraordinary people in here, and many of the people on this panel, they are extraordinary people. And so the rules are a little bit different for some people. But we have to make sure that our young people understand that, yeah, you're right, you can make a mistake, but let's try not to if we can.
Awesome. All right, we got our last question.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lily Estes. I'm from Richmond, Virginia. I want to first say that I applaud all of you for the great work that you've done. I am tremendously excited about that. And as we move forward in terms of grassroots involvement and how I think we have, and I don't know if this is a question or a statement, but I want you to respond if you're led to. But in the work that I've been doing in the trenches, I live in public housing in Richmond, and what I've noticed is there is a mutually exclusive process where we are talking about deconcentration of poverty and deconcentration of public housing. And there is a disconnect profoundly with the status quo elected officials and how the in the trenches people actually bring economic justice to the economic violence that's showing up as benign neglect that's making y'all do the advocacy that you do. So I would like for us to be a little bit more attention to detail as we move forward, because as we look at that, mobilizing the black community for sustainable social change, what I see as a problem is how to keep the in the trenches grassroots engaged and involving, because people who have social means and a lot of economic ability really disconnect the in the trenches people from the policy and planning. Mm-hmm. I was on the Anti-Poverty Commission in the city of Richmond that created the Office of Community Wealth Building. And what I've seen is a gentrification. Excuse me, that's a piece of candy.
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
What I've seen is, you know, people complaining about gentrification, but you've been on city council, you've been in the House of Delegates, you've been the mayor for the last 30 years, and we don't know where gentrification came from. Right. It's on your watch. Yep, right. Yep, yep. So we need to really, and I'm not mad at any of my people who I love, who my friends, who I've been working with for 40 years. But now we got to deal with some strong, profound accountability for people that look like me and a little darker than me. Mm-hmm. And a whole lot darker than me.
Okay? All right, so what are we going to do?
You know, there's been in these positions while gentrification has been coming.
Exactly.
And the economic violence and the economic justice. Now, look for that term, economic justice. I'm getting ready to launch a campaign.
All right.
Be blessed. Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Yes, ma'am.
So what we're going to do.
Yes, ma'am.
It's amazing. Thank you so much. We're going to have you all respond to that, and it will be your closing remarks.
Man, I'm just sitting here. I feel like I just got the Holy Ghost.
I did. Feel like it. I spoke.
Man, that was so powerful, sis. Thank you for your words. I think that the most powerful solutions come from the ground, right? And they come from the people who are closest to the pain. And I think as we're moving forward, a liberation strategy that only centers the vote is a failing strategy. And so
preach.
That is why we are so move to make sure that we are doing stuff in the space of mental health, to make sure that we're doing stuff in the space of economic justice, to make sure that we're doing stuff as it relates to education. All of our organizing is for naught if we do not have leaders in every sector who can sanctuary our work, right? Who can make sure that, you know, if something is going before a city councilor and I can't get off for work that day to be there at a 9:30 meeting in the morning because I got two jobs, right, that it doesn't get overlooked. To make sure that we have thought through, as the gentleman said down there, it's not one thing for me. It takes 5 votes on a city council in my city to make anything happen. So just me running likely is not going to impact or have citywide impact. I got to find 4 other people who have like-minded strategy and who want to do the same kinds of things in our city. And we have to win together for impact. And so we're at the place now where if it does not, we can't just elect people. people, we have to also govern. We also have to be in the churches. We also have to make sure that the kids have opportunities so that they feel like they can dream again. Because at the end of the day, the fact that we have not had safety nets have created a space where people feel like they are in a space of scarcity. And scarcity breeds content. It breeds the kind of lack that we've seen, not just in resources, but in thought. And we exist to make sure that people can think again, that they can dream again. And that is all, that is through the process of voting. If that's how we feel like we're going to do it, that's through the process of having sound policy. That is through the process of electing righteous leaders. And so we thank you, and we hope that you will get involved with us. We're Woke Vote. We're Think Rubix. Follow us. Get involved. We're in every single state that you might be, that you are coming from. And so we're ready to do that work, not just in 2018, but moving beyond. Thank you so much to the National Urban League for having this panel and allowing this voice today. I really appreciate it.
Ma'am, thank you so much. You gave me so much life for the service I have to go to after this. So God bless you. I'm going to walk in with the Holy Ghost on me. Just bless you. A couple of things. One, I think that your call for accountability is extremely important. I think that that now is a season that we really have to hold people's feet to the fire. I do also want to say that even as we're dealing with what's happening in our inner cities and around issues of gentrification, I also want us to be able to pay attention and be forward-thinking enough to deal with the suburbanization of poverty as well. Because if everybody's being moved out of the inner cities, then that poverty, and if you look all over this nation, you are seeing suburbs that are watching about a 20% increase in poverty, and the suburbs don't have the infrastructure to be able to deal with it, and they often try to keep their head underwater, acting like something's not happening that is happening. And so there's going to be a need. So even in churches, we're going around dealing with churches talking about how urban ministry is now going to be done a lot of times in the suburbs. That churches are going to have to rethink even what it means to have an urban ministry. And in the suburbs, it's hidden because folks are more isolated. The transportation systems aren't as connected. The governing system isn't as connected. That nobody is talking from a public policy about poverty that deals in the suburbs. And so all the federal and even state policy is going towards cities. And so therefore, you have just folks who are left out, and food insecurity in the suburbs is jumping up like crazy. And so if we don't start talking about this stuff and dealing with, you got folks who are having to make a decision whether it's going to be whether I'm going to eat or my kids going to eat. I'll eat one meal so my kids can eat two. Y'all see what I'm saying? And so there's a need for us then to hold our leaders accountable on even what's coming down the pike and saying what are your policies about this? That not just what's happening, but what we see is on the way, so that we can be shaping the infrastructure, deal with our people, so that our people can live, and in Scripture, live life more abundantly. That we don't have to just be bound up and bound down all the time, but we can be shaping things in a way so that our people can live life to the full. Thank you so much. Urban League, thank you. Quentin, tell your wife I said hi.
I would love
to. Amen.
And again, echoing what was said before, I want to thank the Urban League for all their support. I mean, we have a very strong chapter in St. Louis led by Mike McMillan. It does a lot. They opened the Quick Trip that was burned down in Ferguson. They acquired that property, reopened it as a Ferguson Empowerment Center, and it is a beautiful building. And I would recommend that you visit it if you ever come to our city. So I'm going to touch upon a couple quick issues in my closing remarks. I think that it is important that elected officials are held accountable. I think that we have to do that. But I think in addition to that, what I see at a lot of council meetings is people coming and saying, you know, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about that? Well, in addition to elected officials being held accountable, I think we all need to hold ourselves accountable as well, because an elected official can only do can only push for change with support. And that the accountability has to be coupled with support, because oftentimes, particularly as an African-American elected official, we're on an island.
That's right.
because we're looking at sound policy, but then we're looking at people, you know, sometimes our own people saying, well, you're not doing enough, but there's some other logistics and things that may not be as visible on a given day. And I can look at the consent decree in Ferguson, which you all heard about. As the sister said before, you can't do anything in our city without four votes. And so when the consent decree was first agreed upon, and I actually had an opportunity to work with the President Obama's Department of Justice. I'm proud to say that I was able to work on the consent decree with his Department of Justice. We still had to get it passed, and we didn't have the votes. And so now we have people, supporters who are supposed to be supporters, saying, well, why aren't you getting it passed? And what I'm trying to tell them is, we all calm down. I'm working on these three votes. but instead of the support, it was just anger. And what happened is that in Ferguson, you had a dynamic where you had people on the council who, if protesters said it, they were going to do the opposite. That's how the relationship had gotten down. And so it was one of those things where a couple of us had to kind of work those relationships and leverage those relationships behind closed doors to get those four votes that we needed. And we were able to do it. And so the point that I'm saying here is, I also want to talk about mental health too, but I'll cut it short. So the point that I'm saying is that we have to make sure that we are holding our elected officials accountable. But when you have elected officials that are really fighting the good fight, we have to make sure that they have our support as well. And I think that that's so important. And then I'm just going to say this real quick, 5 seconds. We have to invest more resources in the mental health treatment. We have to invest in more drug treatment programs. We have too many people that are starting this cycle of incarceration who need treatment. We can't continue to prosecute our way out of mental health issues. We can't prosecute our way out of drug addiction and things of that nature. We have to start investing in those programs, and that is so important to that is incumbent on all of us to make sure that we're aware of those issues.
Thank you.
It's a tough question. Excellent question, but a tough one because I see it in a couple of different ways. I was a dean. You say I don't. I was a dean at Outreach Involvement Center. It was a high school on the south side, right off Hall Street, where 91% of my students live below the poverty line. 68% of my children had one child, and then 51% of them had two children, and this is a high school. We asked them one day, how many of you have witnessed gun violence? 100% of them had done so. We asked them, how many of you have witnessed a murder? 61% of them had said so. And then we asked another question, which I won't ask, but some of them have been committing crimes. So when you're dealing with a population from throughout Richmond who's been, as you know, dealing with a lot of different things, the issues are nuanced and they're layered. But now I'm a professor at Virginia State in Petersburg, and a lot of my students come from Richmond and surrounding areas, and we're trying to teach them, at least in my classes, we're talking about how do you implement and use policy to create change. But just as Brother Bell said, if we don't have the support on the council to implement the policy, then we're not going to be able to create the change. So just like he alluded to, in my council, it was five of us. Our mayor and I, we're about to introduce some stuff to a $50 million bond to redo all of our public housing sites and create more affordable housing. But she and I are only two. We need three. Now, I'm the housing authority rep, the council rep to the housing authority. I've been on this for 4 years now, been trying to figure out, you know, the equity package. I said, all right, I can get a little bit of money. Here's $2.5 million. Let's get it started, which to my colleagues, they thought that was unheard of. And they wanted to fight me every which way. No, Wes, and that's just $2.5 million. Now we're going to come back and say we need a $50 million bond. And some of them already said, Wes, you crazy as hell. You definitely not going to get reelected next year for going through this. So when we talk about our elected officials, I want us to understand those are things that electeds and those who play politics, the politicians, they think about that. So do I want to push forth with a policy that is going to burn all of my capital and then I run the risk of not being reelected and not here to continuously be able to do this work? Or am I just going to say I'm going to go for broke now in these 4 years and I'm going to try to make all the change that we can and whatever happens, happens. Now, that's my position, but I'm also 31. I got a long life, God willing, that I can do a lot of different things. I think about your Mayor Stoney, who's a good brother of mine, or Dwight Jones, or some of your other counselors. They want to be on council and be a mayor for a long time so that they can make change over a long time. It's a sustained amount of change that they want to make. So they're not going to be as bold up front as some of us would want them to be. And then you couple that with, if you do try and get too bold with your positions or the policies that you're pushing, if you don't have the support from the community, your colleagues are going to counsel on council, because we're normally the minorities. They're going to say, we ain't doing that. Go ahead and just go ahead and filibuster and pontificate up here on council and say why it needs to happen. But when it's time to vote, no, no, no. That's how it makes me feel. Push something right off a ledge. So we have to be cognizant of all of the things at play when we're asking our electeds to be able to push. Wesley just said something that was paramount that I don't know if we all got. When he said the activists were coming in and saying, you're not doing this, you need to be doing this, you need to be doing that. And because he's not yelling or being super loud at the council meeting, because he's trying to work backdoor channels to get his colleagues to understand, yeah, you know what? You do need to go with this. It's okay if they're yelling at you. I'm going to handle it. I'm going to talk to them. But the more sometimes we yell, the more it makes them say no. So we have to find that balance, but understand, man, being a black politician or a black elected official is one of the most difficult things that you can do in the world, especially if you're conscious, because you want to make all the change right now, but you're working in a system that is perpetuated on systemic oppression and white supremacy that we have to navigate through. And then our folks have a messiah complex sometimes in which we have to fix everything right now. I love being in our public housing sites. If you want to find me in Charlottesville, you ask Ty. You want to find me, you're normally going to find me in West Haven, which is our biggest public housing site. I just go there and post up and kick it because that's where I feel at home. I'm from Atlanta. I'm not from Charlottesville. So I'm there all the time. But you know what I often get? Damn, Wes, you used to always come to my basketball game. You used to always could take me to the store. You used to always could help me with this application. And I can't do that anymore because I'm trying to run a city and get things for you. So we have to empower each other and understand we all in this together. So in closing, no, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Thank you to the Urban League.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
I'll be real brief because I'm the last person. But my address to this comment that definitely made me think very thoroughly. The Guild president for Memphis actually has this concept that I think is extremely important. It's around knowing your role in the movement for black liberation. Mm-hmm. And I think oftentimes, and take it to church a little bit, sometimes people work outside of their ministry. Mm-hmm. I think that, for real, know what your talents and gifts are and work with that as opposed to aligning yourself to somebody else's gift.
Oh, so I can't be the deacon, the pastor,
you know,
and the treasurer.
That's not your ministry.
That.
You know, you might not need to count no money, be
right.
A deacon and not a trustee.
Right.
But some of the the three components that are really critical to sustaining any type of mobility and progress with the movement is, one, you need activists. It's okay if you're not an activist. I even think about myself. I did some marches because I was a YP president, but that's not necessarily like my strategy for activism. It's just not. That doesn't mean that it's not necessary. That's just not my ministry. You also have your organizers. An organizer is different than an activist. An organizer has to be organized. Have you met an activist that is powerful but are not organized? Like, they can get in front of a large group of people and get you riled up.
Right.
And then that's it, though. But that might not be their ministry to organize. Then the third component of that is your elected official and your person in the boardroom. That makes me think about a Whitney M. Young type of person where they're savvy. You can't necessarily be a boardroom person if you're on the front line in the streets with signs or whatnot, but you still need that person. And I think sometimes we get upset when people are just living in their ministry, but we need to coalesce all of those roles within this movement so that we can truly progress and not step outside of our roles and our lane. The other part that I want to leave with is around addressing classism in the Black community. I think one of the things that is most frustrating is sometimes we, one, and we hear this often and it sounds cliche, but we think about the Black experience from a very monolithic perspective. However, we do have some ounce of privilege. For us to be here today at the Congressional Black, right? I done flew all the way up here from Memphis and took off from work, and they okay with that. That's a privilege for us to be able to convene and have these conversations. But when you think about economic privilege, you have to be able to sow back into our whole Black family, and we have to acknowledge that everyone's experience is not our own. And if we can't come to terms that classism does exist and sometimes hinders us from the progress that we need to make, we won't move forward. That's kind of connecting back, and not to pick on elected officials, but kind of like, don't lose yourself and don't lose sight of what it was all about. Don't lose sight of what it was like when you were grassroots organizers, when you were in the quote-unquote trenches. That's right. Leave that in your spirit when you're navigating through those spaces where we know that it's hard, but remember, you got people that's in their respective ministries. When you're running out and people are getting your nerves, tap into your activists, tap into your organizers, connect with your board members so that we can all work together for the greater good.
Amen.
Let's pass her the collection plate.
The collective plate.
Please join me in thanking Ms. Latricia Adams, Wesley Bell, Juana Thompson, Reverend Tony Lee, and Dr. Wes Bellamy. I just want to remind you all, as Mr. Mark Morial opened us up with, y'all, we are 53 days out from a very critical election.
Seven Tuesdays.
I like that better. There's a historic number of Black candidates running for Congress, running statewide. There's not a single Black governor in this country right now. We can elect 3 in November. Not a single Black attorney general. We can elect 5 in November. Right? Y'all, this work is serious, it's real. And just like whatever you did back in 2007, 2008, whether you were with them or not, you know, people were sacrificing a lot. I dropped out of college to work on the old Obama campaign. Whatever it is that you can do, we need you to do it. Host an event, register voters, make phone calls. There will never be a moment like this in history again when we have this many Black candidates running. And if we don't show that we can do it in November, guess what? We told you so.
Right. Mm.
We told you so. So again, thank the Urban League, this amazing panel. Look forward to seeing y'all throughout the rest of the week. Thank you.
As always, you can follow us on Twitter at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to listen and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Play. Kudos to our communications and policy team here at the Washington Bureau and our editing team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to the National Urban League's For the Movement.